I worry that translation interpreting the way it's going, the sure monetization of translation interpreting as the practice, as a human craft, that this would only reinforce linguistic hegemony and the reduction of linguistic diversity.
Hey, this is Epicenter NYC. We connect our communities to news, information, and each other. I'm your host, Amber Castillo. Language workers across New York City and across the globe are resisting the rise of AI in their field by emphasizing the irreplaceable value of human interpreters and translators. Julie Tay, the director of Hunter College's Master of Arts in Translation and Interpreting program, highlights the need to integrate technology in ways that enhance human roles rather than replace them. She also argues for a language services industry that supports diverse communities without forcing assimilation, worrying about the erosion of linguistic diversity. Today, I sit down with Tay to learn more about her journey in the field, which began in the 1990s. We also discuss the effort to redefine the profession in the face of AI's advancement.
My name is Julie Tay, and I'm the director and lecturer at Hunter College with the master's program in translation and interpreting. Through the 90s, really, I was a pretty much a full-time interpreter. Although it was freelance, I was pretty much contracted fully. My schedule was filled with Berlitz. At that point, it was Berlitz Language Services, with a contract with the USCIS, the Immigration Department. So I was pretty much a immigration court interpreter during those years. From 1992, I would say, through 2001.
Yeah, what language were you interpreting?
In Cantonese and Mandarin.
Did you grow up learning those, speaking those languages?
Yeah, pretty much. Different stages. Yeah, Cantonese more primarily, alongside English and Mandarin at school.
And what drew you to this work in language services?
Well, in those days, the profession was not really codified as such, right? There was no such thing as a language service industry back then. There was very little recognition of the need for language services. And so kind of, I would say that the job came to me rather than the other way around. I was very much in teaching then. So, then word gets around that you have these language competencies. And then it occurred to me that, oh, wow, this is something that I could also do, to supplement my income. So then what happens is, when I'm, as the agencies send me to interpreting situations, and you also end up getting translation work related to those cases, because a lot of cases, they may start with the need for an interpreter for a pretrial or for discovery process, and these law firms find that we might want to connect with this person directly, because then if they go through an agency, chances are the assignment may be random. So I think, that remains an option for translators and interpreters starting out to then go in the direction of running their own business enterprise, small business enterprise. So that was what I ended up doing too. So in addition to the big contract, I also started a small language service center that was situated in Chinatown.
So when you talk about the job or this career coming to you, so there was a certain need that you were seeing. And then was it so much so that that's when you decided to also start your own company? At what point did that decision come about?
Well, here's the thing. It's a little different in my case, I think, than most others that you may interview, particularly if they're younger. So, like I said, in those days, there was no conception of, of a small business that is completely devoted to interpreting or even written translations. So it was very, very few. There were very, very few. And what I remember was in those days, TransPerfect was tiny. It had just started. I remember getting on the phone, with you know, they were the founders of, you know, the earliest iteration of TransPerfect. And then there was another agency, DMAR Interpreting. So these were the people that would be on the phone with me, at, you know, kind of day in, day out. So that just gave me the idea that, hey, you know, maybe I should do something that is specialized in Chinese. And at the same time, because of my background in language teaching, and actually in my case, a particular connection that I have with Chinese cultural arts in Chinatown, so I decided to combine those different elements. So what then I ended up formalizing, right, as a business proposition was actually called the Wosing Center for Chinese. So it was kind of the hub for all sorts of language and cultural arts needs for the community.
Yeah. And because New York especially has such a long history of, you know, immigrants and folks who don't, you know, who are not, who do not speak English as their first language, are there reasons or theories about why there weren't, like you said, like a lot of this field wasn't codified at that time?
Well, because we're living in an English speaking paradigm, and you know, it is the hegemony of white bread America, and basically, you know, if you didn't speak English, as a matter of survival, you're expected to eventually just get over it. And of course, you have a first generation that would suffer, and then later generations buy into the American dream, and of course, you know, work hard and learn English, and it's considered a temporary issue, right? A temporary problem. And indeed, that trajectory of assimilation did kind of work out for most of the 20th century before globalization, before, you know, all of the advance of mobile technology and so forth. So in that sense, people were forced to, you know, like it or not, to get by speaking what little English they can, and then of course living in their enclaves. So most people, in that sense, you know, as long as you accept that, you know, or you, if you choose to live that way, I think it works with Chinese speaking or Spanish speaking, you know, communities. The communities are large enough for people to be pretty comfortable, as long as they're not in trouble with the state, they are not dealing with the outside world. For a lot of Chinese people, even to this day, if you spoke little English, you survive pretty well. You live very well. You know, you go to restaurants, you know, and you can have a lot of money. You hire people to do everything for you. You know, you have accountants taking care of your business, and you know, and lawyers, and you know, those are the bridges, you know, for the outside, the so-called the state, the nation state that we're in. But as far as the nation state is concerned, you know, in fact, translators and interpreters are there to maintain the status quo so that, you know, state officials and anybody in power, anybody in privileged positions, they never have to figure it out. They never have to actually confront an LEP, a low English proficiency person. Why would they? Right,
because they have a mediator.
Exactly, you know, and in fact, when you talk about translators and interpreters, you know, being, you know, representing minorities, and of course, you know, a lot of them, including myself and Daniela here, you know, we represent in that sense, you know, minority communities. On the other hand, it is a very fraught situation. In order to make money, monetize translation interpreting, the work that we do is in service of the state. It's not in service of regular little people who didn't pay for this. They don't get a speaking turn unless they're given one. They're not in charge of these events where, you know, where we interpret. We are there to make sure that the white subject is not unsettled by all of these, you know, diversity.
And especially in the legal system where most of your work has been.
Right. Yeah. And it's, of course, I'm by no means limited, you know, to working for the immigration court. Of course, I also did a whole lot of community interpreting. I've been everywhere. you know, tourism interpreting, where, you know, we have people that are not actually just linguistically interpreting, which to me is brainless mechanical interpreting. And if, you know, if students want to be over obsessed with it, you know, and just narrow themselves down to this at the expense of learning life skills, especially in this day and age where in the first place, your average millennial has lost touch with how to even walk into a party, a room full of people. And then they're going to reinforce that by the monetization of the language skills, the mechanization of it, you know, to serve this imaginary, whether it's court situation or conference interpreting where they're in a room, they don't care what it is they're saying, as long as they said it's so-called right. You discount yourself in the age of AI by doing that, precisely by narrowing the very definition of translation. In fact, taking translation out of it, that kind of interpreting is verbalization.
Has that been something recent that has been tied to these, to AI and these other more recent tech advancements? Or would you say that this separation sometimes of the humanity of language services, that that's something, you know, since the beginning of when you started in this landscape?
Both, I would say. Yeah, you know, the AI thing, of course, right, comes as something that is very striking, right? Yeah, if you look at it, you know, it is really a continuation, you know, it's sort of we're talking about a gradual evolution, especially in the turn of the century, and it's connected to, I think, mobile technology, the digital revolution, you know, the takeover of platform economies, making all transactions much more convenient when we sign up people online. And then with that is the language service industry then taking advantage of all that and then moving from, you know, ground level services to people, in other words, people with the biggest paychecks, right, are not the people, you know, that actually know anything about ground level services. They're people that are aligned with software development. So the priorities have changed, right?
Anything I haven't asked about that you can say in terms of either your motivations or your worries or fears for this field that we haven't covered yet?
I worry that translation interpreting, the way it's going, the sure monetization of translation interpreting as the practice, as a human craft, that this would only reinforce linguistic hegemony and the reduction of linguistic diversity.
Do you see in New York City with, especially with recent, you know, migrants being bused here, do you see that need for, you know, for language, more language access or more folks to help non-English speakers, that's helping combat some of this, that, you know, that the recognition of that greater demand or need?
Yes, I do. And I see hope in the sheer numbers, the unrelenting influx of immigration, regardless of, you know, what the government says, right? Because that is the that, you know, therein lies the power of community. But it's not really the direct work of interpreters and translators, right? There is a fraught situation in which, you know, for all the good intentions of us translators and interpreters, the fact is that the field has become banalized. It's made common, right? It's become sort of, the more there are, you know, bilinguals in our space, especially if you're bilingual in a big immigrant language, right? Not a privileged bilingual like French and English or German. Then, you know, you basically, you are there, like I said, to support, right, the hegemony of English, right, and the officialdom of English. You know, that is my worry.
To read our full story on how language workers like Tay are resisting AI, click the link in our show notes. That's all for today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting us as we do our best to support our community. We couldn't do it without you. For more stories like this, make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at epicenter-nyc.com. Our intro music is All the Pretty Horses by Kara Vika. You can find more of their music on their website, linked to in our podcast description.